are listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, KBOO supporters. Tomorrow is another big give day for Willamette Week's Give Guide, so get ready. When you donate $50 or more to KBOO or any of the 174 other participating organizations on Give Guide, you'll be rewarded with a thank you from A to Z Wineworks. With a donation of $50 or more, you could receive A to Z Rosé Bubbles, Pinot Noir, or even a screen-printed magnum of A to Z Oregon Pinot Noir. Plus, one lucky donor will win a case of A to Z Wineworks Pinot Noir. See details for each gift's minimum eligibility at kboo.fm/give. Donors must be 21 or older to be eligible for all A to Z Wineworks offers. These offers are for your total donated amount throughout tomorrow, so spread your donations across as many organizations as you'd like. Take advantage of this A to Z Wineworks offer during Give Guide's Big Give Day, tomorrow, Thursday, November 12th. For more information about this offer and supporting KBOO through Give Guide, visit kboo.fm/give.
From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On our program today, we'll examine attacks on American democracy. First, Lawrence Lessig will join us to discuss his latest book, They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. Then we'll turn to David Rohde, whose latest publication is In Deep, the FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State. Finally, Victor Picard will take on fake news with his book, Democracy Without Journalism, Confronting the Misinformation Society. That's coming up in just a moment. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the presidential election of 2020 looms large, the many flaws in the U.S.'s current system of democracy come up in conversation, as they do every few years. Primary elections are often flawed and patchwork. The general elections electoral college system effectively undermines the votes of many states' residents. Partisan gerrymandering and attacks on voting rights again undercut democratic power. Campaign finance rules are deeply skewed to allow undue influence from moneyed interests. And still, there are pathways to reclaiming our democracy, as outlined in a new book by my guest, Lawrence Lessig. Professor Lessig is the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School, and he's the host of the podcast Another Way, founder of EqualCitizens.us, and co-founder of Creative Commons. In addition to his many other books, his latest is called They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. Welcome to the program, Lawrence.
Thank you for having me.
So I tried to summarize the flaws in American democracy, but there are so many. What are the flaws in particular that you take on in your book that form the basis of your claim that they, meaning elected officials, do not represent us?
Right. Well, so I think that we have to focus on representativeness as the core objective of a representative democracy. You know, conservatives will tell you, we don't have a, quote, democracy. And that's true. The framers gave us what they called a republic. But by a republic, they meant a representative democracy, and it's kind of in the title, that democracy should at least be representative. And what's so striking about our system of democracy is the way we have evolved corruptions in the institutions of our democracy that make it essentially unrepresentative. So the way we fund campaigns makes it so that a tiny, tiny fraction of the 1% have enormous power compared to everybody else. The way districts are gerrymandered in the House of Representatives makes it so the extremists in the states, whether on the left or the right, have more power than everyone else. The way we elect the president with the Electoral College and a system called winner take all mean that the swing states have all the power, and the majority of the states, the so-called the rest of the country, the non-swing states, are just not important to a presidential candidate. The Senate is obviously deeply unrepresentative. And the way we allow states to suppress the vote of people who are not in the party of the party that's in power is also unrepresentative. So add them all together, and what we've produced is a republic, a representative democracy, that is in no sense representative anymore. And that's a critical reason that we see this democracy failing in so many areas that it needs to succeed.
Right. I mean, we every 4 years suddenly start paying undue attention to Iowa and New Hampshire, relatively, you know, small states that don't figure very hugely in other, or at least compared to states like, say, California or Texas. But it's because of this skewing of our democratic system. So I want to spend the majority of our conversation, because we do spend so many interviews focusing on these flaws in our democracy with good reason. You have suggested many solutions, some of which are already being implemented in smaller scale to these flaws. Let's talk about gerrymandering, which you mentioned earlier. This has been primarily a Republican project, although Democrats have sometimes engaged in it as well. But it's been stuck in the courts, and the Supreme Courts have in particular seemed to come down on the side of allowing partisan gerrymandering, this drawing of these very creative districts, creatively drawn districts that tend to favor one party over another. How can one solve this problem, and are there models that are already in place?
Well, I think it is important to emphasize, before we think about gerrymandering in particular, that we're at a moment when people are talking about broad packages of reform. You know, the House of Representatives in last year in 2019 passed something called HR1,
right,
which was a package of reform that was the most ambitious democracy reform agenda that Congress has considered since the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And it included gerrymandering reform. It included public funding for congressional elections. It included the promise to restore the Voting Rights Act. It included same-day registration, automatic voting registration, and some ethics packages as well. But I think what it reflected most fundamentally is the understanding of many people that there's no silver bullet here, that we have to think about all the ways in which our system has become unrepresentative, undemocratic, and address them together. So gerrymandering is a very clear example of that. People have for many years been thinking the way to address that is to get five justices on the Supreme Court to say the standard should be no partisan gerrymandering. The Supreme Court's made it clear they're not going to do that. And I think that's, in some sense, driving the democratic response, small d democratic response, to say, well, we can do it legislatively. And indeed, Congress has the power in the Constitution to directly require that states no longer use partisan gerrymandering techniques when they draw at least congressional districts. And so what I think is we need to see that reform adopted by Congress, but I would prefer it be adopted in the context of a broad package of reform like HR1 actually was.
And of course, in order for Congress to actually take on such a thing, it seems that we need Democrats in power in both the House and the Senate, since Democrats seem to be the one most interested in making this happen. But in order to make that happen, in order to help Democrats fairly actually get representation in both the House and the Senate, we need some of these reforms in place ahead of time. It's sort of a vicious cycle, you know, or what came first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, so I actually think that it's not going to be sustainable to imagine just one party trying to bring out about this reform. And indeed, if you look at the state level, the reform efforts that have succeeded at the state level have been genuinely cross-partisan reform efforts. So in Florida, when the felon disenfranchisement referendum passed, it passed with 61% of the vote, which means that a significant number of Republicans and independents and Democrats all joined together to address the fundamental unfairness that a person who has served his or her time for a felony should be allowed to return to the status of being a citizen with an equal right to vote. In Michigan, when Michigan overwhelmingly passed an end to gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering at the state level in a referendum that was originally started by a 20-something year old on Facebook, that referendum again was passed by Democrats, Republicans, and independents. Gerrymandering reform in Missouri has been driven by Republicans. South Dakota has had fundamental reform about corruption. So I actually think there are Republicans as well as Democrats in the states who are deeply committed to the idea of democracy reform. It's only in Washington that you see this incredibly partisan spin around democratic reform. And the real cause for that is one senator, Senator Mitch McConnell, who I kind of think of as the dark lord of the United States government. And he, of course, will never allow democratic reform, small d democratic reform, to pass through the United States Congress, which means that the number one thing that must happen for us to get our democracy back is that Mitch McConnell needs to be retired from the United States Senate by electing somebody who would at least allow reform to be considered on the floor of the Senate.
Just one small issue with what you were saying earlier with the Florida story, though, hasn't it been Republican lawmakers that have now stymied that referendum that would have allowed felons to vote by sort of reapplying a poll tax, and they've stopped that in its tracks, in spite of the fact that many, a big percentage of their own base voted for it.
Absolutely. But again, I think that this is the difference between citizens and the politicians.
Yeah.
The politicians are always thinking about how do they rig the system to benefit themselves. And, I think Democrats are better than Republicans, but nobody should think Democrats are pure in this either. Just look at the state of Maryland, which is deeply gerrymandered, or Massachusetts, where I live, deeply gerrymandered to benefit Democrats. So the politicians, of course, are not the ideal. The ideal are citizens. And my point is that ordinary citizens, Republican, Independent, and Democrat, look at the system of government we have and are disgusted. They think that the system is corrupted. And I think there's a real opportunity to unite people on at least this issue, even though we know that we're divided on so many issues. Here at least is one place where ordinary voters agree that we need to fix the corrupted democracy that we've allowed to evolve.
And certainly your comment about Mitch McConnell is on point, given that he has turned the Senate into a legislative graveyard, just a record number of House-passed bills, some even with Republican support, that he has simply not allowed to enter the floor of the Senate, and has, boasted about thwarting President Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee. But one wonders if McConnell wouldn't just be replaced by another Republican leader if Republicans remain in control of the Senate. They seem more enthusiastic than Democratic leaders to abuse the traditions and the rules of representative democracy. One of the huge issues looming around all of this, speaking to your point about we shouldn't trust politicians, is the issue of campaign finance, right? Mostly, politicians, our elected politicians, do the bidding of those who fund their campaigns. We just had a big anniversary of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. So what are some ways in which that aspect of American democracy can be undone or at least reformed?
He who pays the piper calls the tune. This fundamental truth is at the center of everything we should think about when we think about campaign finance reform. So members of Congress and candidates for Congress right now spend anywhere between 30 and 70% of their time dialing for dollars, calling people to raise the money that they need to win their campaign or to get their party back in power. But what we know is they don't call the average American. They're calling the tiniest fraction of the 1%. And that tiny, tiny fraction pay the piper, and they get to call the tune. And so it's no surprise that you can't get any major legislation through Congress that benefits ordinary Americans, the only thing that gets through Congress are the things that benefit this tiny fraction of the 1%. So when Congress was considering the $1.6 trillion tax cut, which benefited primarily big corporations and the super rich, that tax cut was defended on the floor of Congress by a congressman from New York who said his donors told him that if he didn't get that tax cut passed, he should not call those donors ever again. So that was the plainest confession that the policy was being driven by funders of campaigns as opposed to any sense of what's in the interest of Americans. The only way to fix that is to have a system of public funding of elections. And the best system, in my view, is something Seattle does, which is to give every voter what's called in Seattle democracy vouchers, which is basically coupons that they use to give to candidates so that candidates can fund their campaigns. Because what we know is when candidates are raising money in small contributions from tens of thousands or millions of people, they are beholden to the tens of thousands of millions or millions of people, which in a democracy is not a bad thing. That's what we want. We want them to pay attention to the people who are funding their campaigns when the people who are funding their campaigns are the same people who vote for them. So that is, in my view, the most important change that we could make right now. It's completely constitutional under even the Supreme Court's ruling in Citizens United, and it would dramatically affect the corruption in Washington.
And so how has Seattle's system worked? Because we are probably going to be told if we try to enact this at a broader level, oh, there's no money for it, or, you know, we can't hamper the free speech rights of corporations.
Well, you know, the Seattle system doesn't try to silence anybody. What it does is say candidates have an option to raise money from citizens through these vouchers rather than spending all their time in cocktail parties raising large contributions from corporations.
Or wine caves.
Right, wine caves, right. And so I think that what Seattle demonstrates is that when you have that alternative funding source that is independent of special interest money, even if it's not as much as the special interest money, it gives candidates the independence that they need to stand up to the big money. So in the Seattle race, Amazon stepped in and spent what for the size of the elections was an extraordinary amount of money. It wasn't anything to Amazon, but they spent a large amount of money to try to take out city council members who were not as favorable to Amazon as Amazon wished. And what those city council members were able to do using the vouchers was to build a strong enough campaign to resist that onslaught from Amazon and eventually win their campaign against the candidates that Amazon was supporting. So I think that that example, if we imagined it in the country as a whole, suggests that we could begin to elect representatives who had the capacity and courage to stand up to these powerful special interests who are now funding campaigns and actually get representatives who could do the right thing for Americans. That is the most important change that we could make, and I think that's at the center of most of the important democracy reform packages that candidates for president are talking about.
One of the things that you write about in your book that I haven't really heard elsewhere is simply also reducing the number of elected offices in the United States. But if we want to be a representative democracy, isn't it a good thing to have lots of representatives?
No, there's too much of a good thing. When you're voting on, you know, six people to be members of the library board and seven people to be on city council and a person to be sheriff and a person to be comptroller, you know, all these offices demand some kind of understanding and intelligence by the voter. And what we know is we're busy people and we don't need to be exercising our sanction on every one of these types of offices. Obviously,
so do you think it sort of actually contributes to voter apathy to have too many things to vote for?
Absolutely. When you walk into a voting booth and 90% of the people on the voting list you've never even heard of, or if you've heard of them, you've just seen a yard sign, you can't help but feel stupid. You can't help but feel like you're not doing your job as a citizen. And if you don't feel like you're doing your job as a citizen, then many people just don't show up. Now, you know, I think that there are certain offices, obviously, that need to continue to be at the center of our elections, and we should focus on those. But we should not imagine that the solution to every problem with a democracy is just to increase the number of elections or the number of times that we burden or tax the people with making a decision that could more effectively be made by by, you know, better, effective institutions of government.
Lawrence, I want to address an issue that's close to my heart for obvious reasons, and that is the role of the media. Our media are supposed to strengthen our democracy. You know, the freedom of the press is such a critical part of our constitution. And yet, these days, it seems as though at least some aspects of our media industry have undermined democracy in a pretty serious way. And some people in office, in particular, of course, the person occupying the White House, has very seriously undermined the positive role of the media. So what should we be thinking about in terms of the role of media in reclaiming our democracy?
Well, I think that's an incredibly important issue because, you know, the book is kind of ambiguous between they don't represent us, as in the government doesn't represent us. But then the second half of the book is about how we don't represent us, because the way we get rendered in the media through polling and also the consequence of this fractured, polarized media is to present us in a way that is less than who we are. It's less informed, it's less reflective, it's a judgment that is not worthy of the respect that that is appropriate for a democracy.
Thank you so much, Lawrence, for joining us today. Really appreciate it, and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Lawrence Lessig. He's the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School, host of the podcast Another Way, founder of EqualCitizens.us, and co-founder of Creative Commons. We've been discussing his latest book, They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at RU with Sonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. For years, the term deep state was the purview of fringe activists on the right and the left, used to refer to the invisible aspects of governance and policy controlled by America's vast and powerful intelligence agencies. Since Donald Trump's presidency, that phrase has entered the mainstream lexicon, primarily because Trump himself uses it to promote the idea that intelligence officials are secretly working behind the scenes to undermine him. It doesn't help that agencies like the FBI and the CIA have a sordid and well-documented history of violating rights and pushing the envelope of legality. My guest today is David Rode, two-time recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, executive editor of the New Yorker website, and a former Reuters, New York Times, and Christian Science Monitor reporter. He was captured by the Afghan Taliban more than 10 years ago and held for many months before escaping and reporting on the Afghan war. His new book is called In Deep: The FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you, Sonali.
So what does Trump mean specifically when he uses the term deep state? He tweets it all the time. Does he specify what this term means to him?
It's changed over time. Initially, he used the deep state when he was sort of referring to the FBI investigation of his campaign's ties with Russia. He also applied it to CIA officials. It's grown, though. He at one point, he was pushing for an American Special Forces soldier to not be tried by the U.S. military for war crimes. And then he sort of declared the Pentagon at that time part of the deep state. And more recently, Trump himself has not used the term, but many of his supporters have accused Dr. Tony Fauci, you know, one of the country's leading infectious disease experts, of being a member of the deep state as well. And they accuse him of exaggerating the threat of coronavirus as a way to undermine the economy and the president's reelection chances. So part of the reason I wrote the book is because there's these, that no one's clear sort of what exactly the term means, and many people, including the president, use it in different ways.
Where did the term originate? Obviously, Trump didn't come up with it. I mentioned that it's been a favorite of, you know, conspiracy theorists on the right and on the left. Is it a uniquely American term?
No, it was actually first used to describe the military in Turkey. And political scientists use it to talk about the tendency of the military there to try to block the development of democracy in the country. Some people applied it to the military in Egypt as well. And the first, you know, example I could find of it being used in the United States was actually by an academic in California, Peter Dale Scott. He's a retired professor from the University of, UC Berkeley. And in a 2007 book, Scott applied the term deep state for the first time, as far as I could tell, to the American government. And he came from more of a critique from the left. Scott argued that the American deep state, and he defined it as sort of military contractors, generals. He also talked about it as financial interests on Wall Street, had pushed the U.S. into endless wars and before and after 9/11. So he used it in his book. But again, he was coming more from the left perspective of the military-industrial complex.
So if we focus on the definition, at least Trump's definition of the deep state, including or encompassing today's intelligence agencies, I want to ask you to lay out for those who, you know, aren't scholars of the American government system, what the relationship is supposed to be between agencies like the FBI, the CIA, which of course under the FBI being under the purview of the Justice Department, and the White House, the executive branch. The president is supposed to appoint heads of these agencies, but there's supposed to be a firewall between them, right? They're supposed to be independent.
They're supposed to be independent, and we can talk about this more, but there was a series of investigations in the 70s by Congress, and there was a decision that it was very important that the FBI and the CIA, given their power, not be used for political purposes by presidents. And it was also, you know, deemed that FBI officials and CIA operatives, you know, would not be distorting the information that they were providing to the president. And the reason for this is that many of our sort of biggest intelligence debacles, anywhere from the Bay of Pigs to the Iraq invasion in 2003, came about when, you know, intelligence analysts were sort of telling presidents what they wanted to hear. Part of those reforms also was that there would be oversight of these agencies by Congress as well. In the late 70s, after these abuses were found, new intelligence committees were created in Congress, in the House, and the Senate. A new system was created where the president, instead of, you know, the president would have sort of a verbal communication with the CIA director about, you know, covert action programs the U.S. was carrying out. After these reforms, the president had to sign a written covert action finding. That document was then given to the heads of both parties in Congress. And there was also a ban on the U.S. carrying out assassinations, the CIA carrying out assassinations abroad, or CIA agents posing as journalists. And lastly, the judicial branch was involved as well. A special court was created, the FISA court, to monitor efforts by the FBI to surveil Americans as part of counterterrorism or counterintelligence investigations. And so the goal was to have overlapping oversight. You'd have a president overlooking the agencies, and you'd also have Congress and the courts as well.
So we are in a place now where President Trump has, you know, conveniently used this idea that these intelligence agencies are working against him to undermine legitimate investigations of how his campaign conducted itself, of how he and his colleagues have conducted themselves during his presidency. It's a very convenient ruse, and his base seems to buy it. It's also one that's promoted by Fox News, right?
It is, and I'm going to try to be the, if it still exists these days, the sort of more non-partisan journalist. Look, there is no question, as you said at the very beginning of the interview, there's a long history of CIA and FBI abuses. What did change with these reforms in the 70s is the misconduct that's happened since then. It's usually been at the direction of presidents. George W. Bush, you know, told the CIA to carry out rendition and torture. George W. Bush, you know, told them to carry out warrantless mass surveillance. President Obama, you know, carried out a record number of drone strikes around the world to counter terrorism. So the idea of these rogue agencies, that really hasn't happened in the last 40 years. And I essentially came to the conclusion that the term deep state is political rhetoric. I don't like it. I think it's, you know, it's inaccurate. It sounds like a conspiracy. If you really like government, you know, a term you could use that I think is also political rhetoric would be like good government. I think there's a permanent government. I use the term institutional government. We have these institutions that continue to function no matter who's president. But what's different is, you know, every president has come to Washington and complained about these institutions, these bureaucrats. They'd say, you know, they leak stories. You know, but what I found is that the loyalty of most career civil servants is to their institution. They will leak stories to influence policy. They'll fight for turf or bigger budget. You know, Ronald Reagan came to Washington and complained the State Department was, you know, not implementing his tough on communism policy. Barack Obama came to Washington. He was suspicious of the Pentagon. He thought Pentagon generals were leaking large proposed troop increases in Afghanistan to force Obama to send a large number of troops. But, you know, I found no evidence of a deep state, of a coup, you know, a plot against President Trump. I think he's, you know, he's exaggerating what's happening, and he uses the term very effectively to discredit enemies. Any sort of officials who question him or question or contradict his political messages, you know, are declared members of the deep state.
And on the contrary, now his Justice Department, and I say his because Attorney General William Barr has acted more often like the president's personal attorney than the chief, you know, than the nation's attorney general. Trump's Justice Department seems to be engaged in a very overt conspiracy to punish anybody who has tried to investigate Trump, anybody who was involved in not just the special counsel's investigation, but also the impeachment proceedings, the initial whistleblower complaint that led to the impeachment articles around the involvement with the Ukraine government. That's all out in the open, right? Let's talk about William Barr and the role that he has played.
So Barr is a central character in the book. And long before, you know, Donald Trump was running for president, Barr felt that these reforms that were enacted in the 70s were excessive, he felt, that they gave Congress and the courts too much power. Barr was one of a number of conservatives who felt that the presidency was weakened too much in the wake of Watergate. Other people who agreed with him were two aides to President Ford. They were very young at the time, but that was Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. And Antonin Scalia, who was a conservative legal scholar at the time but went on to become a Supreme Court justice, felt the same way. So Barr's worked for years. He worked in the Reagan White House. Ed Meese, Reagan's attorney general, also was focused on trying to restore the power of the presidency. And this moment under President Trump, you know, Barr has completely embraced this. He argued in a speech last fall to the Federalist Society that we need a stronger executive branch, that when you look historically at which branch of the government has saved the country when it faces natural disaster or war, you know, or economic crises, it's been the executive branch. And so he was, you know, Barr complained about, you know, a federal judge in, I think in California on the West Coast, stopping President Trump's travel ban, that was an infringement on a president's power as Barr reads the Constitution. He's criticized these investigations by Congress as overkill, and he believes special counsel should not be appointed, that again is an infringement of the power of the president to run the executive branch as he sees fit. So he's very dismissive of the Mueller investigation, and you're right, he's launched an investigation of the investigators. he's accused them of wrongdoing. He dropped the charges against Flynn. And now, you know, other legal scholars say this is, you know, a disaster. It's rebalancing the sort of basic division of powers that's a core of our democracy, where you have three co-equal branches of government that compete with each other and act as checks on each other. So I came to the conclusion in the book that sort of under the guise of stopping a coup that doesn't really exist, Trump, you know, with the help of Bill Barr, is sort of rebalancing the division of powers in American democracy. And it's a very stark and I think dangerous trend that's happening.
Yes, it's quite shocking. We also, there was just, as an aside, a recent interview where William Barr, when asked about his decision to drop charges against a former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, when he was asked how history would view his actions, he started his answer saying, "History is written by the winners." Let's focus also on the George W. Bush administration. Your book is about the FBI, about the CIA, and about Trump's claims of a deep state. The CIA, especially during the Bush administration, this is the second Bush administration, became an especially notorious agency, particularly around the war on terrorism. Why is this a critical part of the story?
Because the story is really the effort to control the FBI and CIA, and it starts with these reforms again in the late 70s, and Bush flouts them. He essentially says, "I, as president, you know, can carry out a mass surveillance program, and I don't need to go to this FISA court, the federal court that was created to stop abuses." And there was, you know, very famous legal memos written by John Yoo, who was in the Justice Department at that time, authorizing the use of torture and renditions and other methods to combat terrorism. Many Americans, you know, did support those methods. There was a huge upturn in support for a powerful presidency and for the FBI and the CIA after 9/11. But I think many people were troubled by, you know, the methods that were used. Bush, once the New York Times reported the existence of the mass surveillance, it was very unpopular, and Bush ended up going to the court and getting permission. So the idea of checks and balances of, you know, controlling a president and controlling how the CIA and FBI are used is popular among Americans. But, you know, the president Trump has been very effective at saying, no, you know, there is the problem are these unelected officials, you know, I'm the elected president and they're, you know, trying to overthrow me. Again, I even had members of Trump's own administration agree that was an exaggeration. Again, Trump officials, I talked to Obama administration officials, Bush administration officials, Clinton administration officials, lots of frustration with the machinations of bureaucrats in Washington. But even Trump's own aides said no evidence of a coup.
How do you, as a journalist, assess the FBI's role and in intelligence community's role in trying to unearth what the Trump campaign and eventually the Trump presidency was engaged in? It was under Obama that the investigations into what Michael Flynn's, you know, what Michael Flynn did or did not do started, his connections, his contact with Russian operatives. Do you assess whether the investigation was fairly started?
I do. I partly based on, there was a review by the Inspector General of the Justice Department, Horowitz, that found they were properly launched. And I interviewed James Baker. He was the general counsel of the FBI and involved in the launch of the investigations. I didn't speak to former Director Comey. And, you know, Baker stands by the launch of the investigations, and that actually occurred in July of 2016. You know, the DNC emails had been stolen and by Russia, it was believed. President Trump had publicly asked Russia at that point to find Hillary Clinton's emails. And there was this report of a Trump campaign operative, George Papadopoulos, you know, saying that Russia had dirt on Hillary Clinton and wanted to share it. And they launched the investigation. At that point, they didn't have the dossier by Christopher Steele, much of which has proven to be false, was not instrumental to the launch of the investigation. And then as a reporter, I spent the summer of 2016 trying to confirm that the FBI was investigating Trump's campaign, you know, and the FBI refused to confirm that they were. They didn't confirm it with any journalists that summer. Again, if there was an FBI plot to derail the Trump campaign, the easiest way to do that would have been to leak the fact that they were investigating Trump. They never did that. In fact, James Comey reopened the Hillary Clinton email investigation days before the election, which hurt her. And just one other anecdote, I went to James Clapper for an interview. I was doing a story about the CIA, and I asked him about reports in the Steele dossier of, you know, that Russia had compromising videotapes of Donald Trump. This was about 6 months before the 2016 election. And I asked Brennan if he could confirm that there were such tapes. And Brennan, you know, declined to comment. He said, I'm not confirming this thing you've heard about tapes. I'm not denying this thing you've heard about tapes. I don't want to go anywhere near this. And Brennan actually urged me. He said, you're going to hear a lot of crazy things about, you know, Donald Trump over the last few weeks of the campaign and crazy things about Hillary Clinton. You know, he urged me to be more conservative than ever in terms of what I reported before the election. So no, you know, I'm not saying we should trust the CIA or the FBI.
Right. Well, David, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book and thanks for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you so much.
My guest has been David Rode. He's a 2-time recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, executive editor of the New Yorker website, former Reuters, New York Times, and Christian Science Monitor reporter. And we've been discussing his new book, In Deep, The FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. There was a time when American journalism was considered the envy of the world. With a constitutionally guaranteed freedom of the press, journalism flourished, and by and large, journalists showed a healthy skepticism of power, and elites showed the press a modicum of respect. Today, as the term fake news is both a real phenomenon and a weapon in the service of propagandists, it's harder for the public to tell what is truth and what is not. Journalism is essential to democracy. Can there be democracy without journalism? Joining me to help answer that question is Victor Picard, associate professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at University of Pennsylvania, where he co-directs the Media Inequality and Change Center. He's written widely about media, the news, communication, and democracy. And he now joins me to discuss his newest book, Democracy Without Journalism, Confronting the Misinformation Society. Welcome to the program, Victor.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So I understand that your approach to examining journalism and the media is looking at the economic model by which most commercial media is organized. And you say that you start from an assumption that commercial journalism has always been in crisis. Why?
Yes, excellent question. I think that, if you look at the history of the American press, you see that from the very beginning, from the dawn of commercialization in the late 1800s, you see these tensions where the commercial imperatives, the need to make money, have often overwhelmed the democratic imperatives, the need to inform the populace and to provide a forum for diverse views and voices. And at various points in our history, we've seen these crises flare up where the commercialism really drives our journalism into dangerous places. And I think we're going through one of these crises right now. And arguably, the crisis we're facing now is an existential one for the American press.
So the corporate model of journalism has sort of from the start been the American way, right? Where even though we've had and still have PBS and NPR, which are arguably government funded. I mean, the only tiny percentage of their funding comes from the government. We do have C-SPAN. In other countries, you have main media like the UK's BBC or Australia's ABC, Canada's CBC. In the US, has publicly funded media always taken a backseat to commercial media?
Yes. As you note, I think compared to other countries, there's a degree of American exceptionalism at work here where we pay so little per person per year for our public media. We're almost literally off the charts. We pay about $1.40, about the price of a cheap cup of coffee to support our public media. This has changed at various points throughout history, but certainly compared to media systems around the world, the American system has been hyper-commercialized. And I think this doesn't explain all of our problems, but it explains a lot of them, from shouting heads on television to clickbait online. There is this excessive commercialism that's driving a lot of the media content. And I think that's the part of our analysis, even among left-leaning media critics, we often don't look at the underlying structural reasons for why our media is so bad so often.
So you mentioned clickbait. So social media is a relatively new phenomenon. And social media is very much, and many of the sort of online world of information sources is very much premised on the idea of an advertising-based model as well. Almost sort of a traditional corporate media model on steroids, right? I believe it was YouTube that just released its ad revenue recently, showing that it makes billions and billions of dollars a year on those little ads that they play right before videos. So did social media sort of supercharge the decline of journalism and the over-commercialization?
Right. I think social media deserves a lot of blame for many of the problems that we're dealing with, but I certainly wouldn't say they're the cause of it. They've exacerbated the journalism crisis. One of the factors that you did mention, although we're talking a lot about advertising right now in our conversation, but right now Google and Facebook gobble up almost all the digital advertising revenue online. And what that means is that the news creators, the content producers, especially news organizations, are being deprived of much of their financial sustenance. But again, I wouldn't put it all the blame on the platform monopolies as much as they are culpable. I think the bigger problem is that when you move to the web, when advertisers and readers move to the web, digital advertising pays pennies to the dollar of traditional print advertising. And that's because, as you know, our media system in the States has been so overly dependent on advertising revenue. So when you move to the web, this business model is blown to bits, and it's never coming back. And that, again, is also the problem when we have such a weak public media system in the United States. We don't really have a safety net but when the market fails to support the journalism that democracy requires.
Now, traditional corporate media often make a lot about objectivity, claiming that they provide unbiased news and you have the standard, well, let's balance our sources if we, you know, give some space for a quote from a Democrat, let's throw in a Republican to show that we are pure balanced. What are the assumptions and biases that go hand in glove with the corporate model, but are rarely talked about?
Yeah, and again, oftentimes this gets narrated, American journalism gets narrated in a way where there was this cultural progression towards professionalized journalism. And that's certainly part of the story, but there again is this economic imperative that we rarely look at. And historically, this clinging to objectivity, sometimes called the objectivity norm in professional journalism, was a way to please advertisers more than audiences. It was a way to not alienate large swaths of an audience, but also to rely on official sources, which was always cheaper to do, safer to do. And this skewed content, it skewed much of our journalism in a way where it would protect the status quo instead of challenging it. And I think it is this commercialism that is driving that. And that commercialism is always about selling advertising. It's about delivering audiences, delivering us, delivering our eyes and ears to advertisers who are trying to capture our attention. And this is true for mainstream news media. It's true for Facebook and other social media. This is the driving force in so much of the American media system, and this is exactly what I argue needs to be changed.
Does this model then sort of predictably show skepticism and even open hostility to forces that threaten the economic system on which it's based? I'm thinking of the huge slew of articles and op-eds against Senator Bernie Sanders, against Elizabeth Warren, against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, anybody who critiques the corporate model, who might call themselves a democratic socialist, not all of the aforementioned do, seem to receive pretty negative treatment from the media. Does that have anything to do with the fact that the rhetoric of these politicians undermines the business model of the newspapers in question?
Yes, I think it does. I mean, there's always a lot of nuance here, and it takes some time to unpack it. I would argue that it's first this kind of economic imperative that drives much of our media system. It's about making a profit, but there is an ideological consequence to that, an ideological orientation to especially our elite, our mainstream media, and it plays out in a way where any voice, any opinion that is outside this very narrow parameter gets treated with a lot of scrutiny, is often dismissed, and I do think you're seeing some of this around Bernie Sanders and the way the campaign is getting treated, the way our politics are being framed. But I would say even a greater consequence, which does play against people like Bernie Sanders, who wants to talk about policy, or even Elizabeth Warren, who's very much focused on policy. Much of our media system is about trivializing our politics, sensationalizing things, focusing on conflict, focusing on petty personal disputes, or even things like what are they wearing during the debates. This I think you can trace back to that commercial mission of our media, but certainly there is this ideological policing that happens, and we're seeing this. I think we'll see more and more of this, especially as Bernie Sanders continues to do well.
I just want to mention the recent Washington Post op-ed by Dana Milbank called "Is Bernie Sanders Really Happening?" focused entirely on this writer's observations of Sanders's body language during the Senate impeachment trial. Literally detail after detail about how he sat, how he sighed, how he coughed, how he ran his hands through his hair or didn't. It was pretty amazing to watch that. And of course, it was negative. So would you say then the current state of the media is an inevitable outcome of the commercial economic model? And if so, is our political landscape today the result of that? Because of course, when journalism erodes, democracy erodes.
Yes, I would say all these things are related. As scholars, we're always careful not to sound over-determined. You know, we don't want to be too reductive. But I would, so I tend to steer clear of that term inevitable. But I would say that in a commercial media system, it is highly likely. I mean, in a capitalist society, it's highly likely that our media and political systems would play out in this way. And that's why I argue that as much as possible, we need to be taking our news media out of the market. And that, you know, that goes back to your earlier question about kind of the ideological paradigm that's driving a lot of our media. In many cases, it's the market itself that's doing the ideological work of the Trump administration. I mean, it's hollowing out newsrooms, it's driving journalism into the ground. And so that's why I argue that we need to take journalism out of that commercial model. We need to decommercialize it. We need to create a public model. And that, I think, is our best case solution. And this applies to our political system as well. We need to get money out of politics as much as possible.
And of course, everything you're saying would be denounced by the naysayers as socialism, socialist, anti-capitalist, anti-American, un-American, and therefore dismissed outright.
Right. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't argue for it anyway. And, you know, if you look around the world and if you look in our own history, these kinds of arguments, whether it's democratic socialism or social democracy, these things are as American as apple pie. I mean, we've always recognized market failure. We've always subsidized our core systems. If you go back to the postal system, that was highly socialistic. So just because these words have become stigmatized and there's been these ideological battles to try to delegitimate them, I think Bernie Sanders is sort of exhibit A for how people aren't scared of socialism as much anymore. They're not as enthralled to market fundamentalism, especially among young people. And I think that's a very good thing.
So what would a truly public media system look like? And even actually before we get to that question, there were a lot of expectations and predictions that the traditional newspaper industry would die out. And indeed, newsrooms across the country did close down. But then you had the sort of cream of the crop, like the New York Times and the Washington Post and et cetera, survive. And what they've done is they've turned to this online subscription model. They've put up paywalls. After the first five articles a month, you know, subscribe in a way that's not terribly unaffordable. And so it seems as though they're surviving and pretty well right now with pretty high numbers of subscriptions. That's one way to do it. And it's how Pacifica has tried to do it, although we can't put a paywall up on the airwaves. But then there's just having actual government support through taxpayer funded subsidies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of these models that you mentioned have been tried, are being implemented in different places in different ways. For the most part, the paywalls that you mentioned, the subscription model, is only working for the big papers like New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post. Most smaller papers are not able to sustain themselves. And we're talking about smaller papers, even large metro dailies. Haven't been able to sustain themselves just on subscriptions alone. So what this suggests is that the market really is not going to support the journalism we need. There really isn't a commercial option. That's why I keep coming back to the public media option. And whether we think about it in terms of direct subsidies, I like to think of it as just public investments. There are different ways we can do this. There are different sources from which we can draw the money. Even looking at infrastructure, like making sure people have access to broadband, these all should be part of the same conversation that we need to be providing people with the media they need.
Victor, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, Sonali. I really enjoyed talking to you.
My guest is Victor Picard, Associate Professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at University of Pennsylvania, where he co-directs the Media Inequality and Change Center. He's written a number of books about media, and we've been discussing his latest. It's called Democracy Without Journalism, Confronting the Misinformation Society. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes, and now Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO is excited to be part of Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO,